This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there, welcome to the program. The man about to lead Australia's biggest Catholic community is calling on a fellow bishop to quit because he was convicted of covering up child sexual abuse. In an exclusive interview, Melbourne's new Archbishop Peter Comensoli tells Philip Wilson of Adelaide to put the needs of victims and ordinary Catholics first.
The path that Archbishop Philip is taking is not of benefit for God's people in Adelaide. So I, along with a number of other bishops, have sought to counsel Philip in that regard.
This is the Religion and Ethics Report. I'm Andrew West. That story is soon. And how did Buddhist ritual help the Thai soccer team survive 2 weeks trapped in a flooded cave? Donald Trump has given his evangelical Christian supporters another reason to smile. He's nominated a religiously conservative judge to fill a vacancy on the US Supreme Court. Brett Kavanaugh ticks all the boxes for a Trump judicial appointee, pro-life and apparently committed to the laws protecting freedom of religious conscience. Emily McFarlane Miller is a national correspondent for the Religion News Service in the US, and she joins us from Chicago. Emily, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do we know about the religious background of Brett Kavanaugh?
Well, Brett Kavanaugh, like Justice Anthony Kennedy, who he replaces, Catholic, he was very quick, actually, to mention his Catholic faith in his speech accepting the nomination for the Supreme Court. He mentioned his Jesuit high school, saying that its motto was men for others, and that's a creed he's tried to live. He also mentioned that he is part of what he called, quote unquote, the vibrant Catholic community in the D.C. area. Mm. We know he is a regular lector at his church, the Shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament in Washington, D.C., and he also volunteers for the St. Maria's Meals program at Catholic Charities, and he tutors at the Washington Jesuit Academy. So we know quite a bit about his own personal faith there.
What do you think was behind that determination to discuss his Catholic faith?
It sounded like the way he was using it in his speech was really to underscore this commitment to service that he has. We also know that President Trump's support comes largely from white evangelical Christian base. You know, this could be also speaking to those supporters, to the people who largely we've been hearing from since this announcement are supportive of his nomination as well.
What have the evangelicals and indeed other religious leaders been saying?
We've heard from a number of Donald Trump's informal evangelical spiritual advisors. One of those is Robert Jeffress, who's senior pastor of First Baptist Church of Dallas. He says evangelicals are ecstatic because in less than 2 years, President Trump has filled a second Supreme Court vacancy with a second conservative, just as he promised. The fact that the president chose another conservative justice is more important than the name of that justice. This is a huge win for President Trump. We've also heard from Paula White, who is said to be Trump's closest spiritual advisor going back before the presidential campaign. Yeah, she has a church in Florida and also a televangelism ministry. She said if Trump hit a home run with Justice Gorsuch, his previous pick, in the nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh, he's hit a grand slam. We've heard from a number of other advisors. Samuel Rodriguez, who is president of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference and read scripture at Trump's inauguration, said that he hopes instead of, quote unquote, another vitriolic and divisive political battle, the confirmation process would instead be a reaffirmation of the strength of our democracy and its institutions. Also, Ralph Reed, another informal advisor and founder of the conservative Christian group Faith and Freedom Coalition. He also has a statement supporting this nomination as well.
Emily, that is a roll call of the religious right in America, which is to be expected because, as you say, evangelicals, 81%, have supported Donald Trump. But have there been dissenting religious voices from this nomination of Brett Kavanaugh?
I got several statements from leaders in the United Church of Christ, which is a mainline Protestant denomination, who have expressed concerns that a conservative court with Justice Kavanaugh could threaten women's reproductive rights, LGBTQ rights, workers' rights, as well as advancements on matters of climate change. They've also expressed concern, quote unquote, not whether the candidate is progressive or conservative in their religious beliefs, but rather that faith would be a determining factor at all. We've also heard opposition from Americans United for separation of church and state.
Which incidentally was formed, I think, by a Protestant clergyman many decades ago. What sort of cases is Brett Kavanaugh now likely to hear on the Supreme Court where his religious beliefs might come into play?
That's a good question. Recently, we've had a lot of Supreme Court cases that have had religious implications. There was the Masterpiece Cake Shop decision just recently. There was the travel ban, which many people view as a ban on Muslims entering the country.
And yes, just to clarify, the Masterpiece Cake Shop, that was the decision where the court ruled in favor of a baker who declined to bake and decorate a cake for a same-sex couple.
Yeah, and what's interesting about that decision is that it focused more on how the Civil Rights Commission handled the case more than actually the question of whether one can cite religion to refuse services to LGBTQ people. So that's still a question that needs to be settled that could come back in another case to the Supreme Court in the future. This October, there is a case concerning capital punishment, which is important to a lot of people of faith. Also, a lot of the discussion that we're hearing here in the U.S. is if it might be possible with a conservative court to revisit Roe v. Wade, which is the landmark decision legalizing abortion in the United States.
You wrote before Justice Kavanaugh was nominated that he may in fact not be as hardline as some people think he is as far as abortion is concerned.
There's some conservatives who have expressed concern that he's not conservative enough. He did rule on one abortion case. It was a controversial decision that allowed an undocumented teenager who had crossed from Mexico into Texas as an unaccompanied minor to get an abortion while living in a government-funded shelter. He wrote of that decision, it was ultimately based on a constitutional principle as novel as it is wrong, a new right for unlawful immigrant minors in U.S. government detention to obtain immediate abortion on demand.
Yeah, that seems a pretty hard line decision, though. Emily, where would conservatives have room to doubt him on abortion?
Well, his reasoning in that case was, to some, more pragmatic and less restrictive than the reasoning that a number of other judges gave. Similarly, conservatives favor his dissent opposing the birth control mandate in another case, but also worry because it conceded that the government had an interest in providing coverage for contraceptives, even if he believed that the government could achieve that in other ways. So there's some concern that his decisions don't quite go far enough for some conservatives. Of course, on the other hand, you have LGBTQ groups who have expressed concern in the opposite direction about the fact that he's been promoted by conservative Christian groups like the Family Research Council, which is a Christian lobbying group that is opposed to homosexuality and says that it cannot be affirmed. So there's some pushback on both sides there.
Yes, Australia is debating religious liberty right now and whether we need new laws to strengthen it in the aftermath of legislation that legalized same-sex marriage. So what indications do we have about how broad Brett Kavanaugh's view of religious liberty should be in American law?
Particularly as it applies to LGBTQ rights, there aren't a lot of decisions that he's made on that. But he has ruled in a number of other cases having to do with religious liberty. There was a piece in the National Review just recently that called him, quote unquote, a warrior for religious liberty and noted that he had chaired the Federalist Society's religious liberty practice group in the 1990s. Mm. He had offered pro bono work for cases defending religious freedom, and he had represented a synagogue pro bono in a local zoning dispute.
This is the fifth Catholic to be appointed, I think, to the Supreme Court bench. Mm-hmm. There's five Catholics, there's three Jews, and there's one Gorsuch, nominally an Episcopalian. Where are the evangelicals on the court whom Donald Trump relies on for this support? I don't think they've ever really had a presence on the Supreme Court. Why are they willing to settle for five Catholics? 50 years ago, this would have been unheard of.
You're right. Historically, the Supreme Court has been overwhelmingly Protestant. But with Kavanaugh's nomination, actually, the religious makeup won't change at all because he replaces Justice Kennedy, who is also Catholic, Justice Gorsuch, as you mentioned, he attends an Episcopal church. He was raised Catholic as well, and he's never actually commented on which religious identity he identifies with. You know, it's an interesting question. It sort of depends how you define evangelical. There are some that would define evangelical simply as conservative, in which case there are a number of seemingly conservative Christians on the board that wouldn't preclude Catholics.
Emily Miller, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you so much.
Emily McFarlane Miller is national correspondent with the Religion News Service, and this is the Religion and Ethics Report. Catholic Archbishop Philip Wilson of Adelaide made history recently for all the wrong reasons, sentenced to 12 months home detention for not reporting the sexual abuse of a boy by another priest in the 1970s. Philip Wilson is appealing his conviction and won't resign. He's only stood aside. But now the bishop who's about to lead the Melbourne Archdiocese, which is Australia's biggest, believes Philip Wilson should step down. Bishop Peter Comensoli has also told RN's Noel Debien about another abuse case and why the offending priest should not be deported to Ireland.
In all of what seems to be a terrible impasse where Archbishop Philip has chosen to not offer his resignation and has rightly said that as a citizen has a right to appeal, which he has done, but in all of that there remains what is good for the people of God in this circumstance, and most particularly what would be good for the people of the Archdiocese of Adelaide. And for those reasons, I think the path that Archbishop Philip is taking is not of benefit for God's people in Adelaide. So I, along with a number of other bishops, have sought to counsel Philip in that regard.
If you were in that position, would you step aside, resign your role as Archbishop to appeal the case knowing that it will go on for years yet?
I don't know how I would react personally. I mean, those sort of hypotheticals are precisely that. As someone who's not having to try and defend my name, and Philip is strongly holding to his innocence, and I respect that, so how I would react, I don't know. I would hope, though, that this sense of how might my service of God's people operate best in this regard.
But there are people who are saying, you know, why don't the bishops remove him? Why isn't he sacked? What is, from your point of view, the answer to that?
Well, actually, it's a relatively simple thing. A bishop has jurisdiction over his diocese. He has that as a mandate from the Pope. I have no jurisdiction over a fellow bishop. No one bishop has any jurisdiction over another bishop. In fact, I can call out to the cows come home for someone to resign or to give up their diocese or so on, and it might have some value by way of influence, but it has no authority about it. If a bishop is to be asked to resign, it can only come from the Pope. From the Holy Father.
You're taking up the largest diocese in Australia, but it's also unique in that it has a thing called a Melbourne response, its own response to clerical sexual abuse. The rest of the country, including your current diocese, has Towards Healing. Both systems have been criticised, both have done good, both have done bad, but the Melbourne one has been criticised particularly for being too legalistic. Do you have any attitude you go into Melbourne knowing that you're about to inherit a system that is different from the one you govern right now?
I go into Melbourne with an entirely different system emerging in the country. We have a redress scheme now, which the Catholic Church was in favour of very early on. I think we were probably the first to come out and support that, and we've signed up and so on. I don't think it's going to be either the Towards Healing or Melbourne response.
Am I understanding that what you're saying, Archbishop-elect Comensoli, is that the Melbourne response is sort of a moot point because new things are happening with the redress scheme? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, I think that's a fair remark. I think that something new will emerge. I think I can confidently say that there is indeed efforts to bring about that.
Your own diocese that you're about to leave, Broken Bay, has had problems within it as well in this regard. Father Finian Egan's been in the news recently, and you've been mentioned in regard to him because Minister Dutton has suggested he should be deported. He's Irish, he's 82 or 83. We should deport him because he's been convicted of crimes against children. But he remains officially still a priest, and you have reportedly used your voice to say, no, he should remain and we will monitor him. And you've written in his defence for remaining in the country. That would be confusing for some people. Why did you choose to give him a reference to stay as opposed to have him removed from the country?
So when Finian Egan was still in jail, this is, we're talking some 18 months ago, a bit longer, when this all happened, it came to light that the minister was looking to deport him when he was eventually come out of jail on parole. At that time, there was quite a significant discussion going on in the Royal Commission about the question of whether priests should be laicised or in fact kept within the fold, so to speak, precisely on the question of what would be ways of protecting from the possibility of abuse. It was an open question in the Royal Commission. We now know through the recommendations that they settled on a decision around laicisation, but that came some 12 months after I wrote my letter. I did some research into what would it mean for someone to be deported to Ireland, and I learnt in that little bit of research that there would be no civil protections put in place either. When Finian has, as I now know, is on parole, the set of restrictions that are put in place civilly are quite extensive, and anything that I do from a church perspective is in addition to what the civil restrictions are. None of that would have existed if he'd been deported to Ireland. So the ongoing dimensions of his sentencing, if you like, so his sentence was for 8 years, 4 years in jail, he's now on parole, none of that transfers to Ireland. So he would have gone to Ireland, in a sense, an entirely free citizen. I just could not fathom the logic of that, that he might go somewhere and be entirely unrestricted in his living and behaviour and so on. My focus entirely in terms of Finian has been on how do we protect children.
If I'm understanding that correctly, I had heard during the commission arguments made that if a priest is laicised or defrocked, you as their bishop no longer have any authority over them ecclesiastically. You've got no control at all. They're free agents, basically, if they're defrocked. And that there are people who argue that priests should not be, because at least then a bishop has the responsibility and the ability to both monitor and also observe and to advise and, in fact, to direct. Are you persuaded by that argument?
In the Finian Egan situation, whether he is in the end dismissed from the clerical state, certainly the process is open. That's public knowledge that I commenced the process when he was released from jail. If in the end that he is defrocked, he's still under civil restrictions in our country. That would not be the case in Ireland. That's the point I want to keep stressing here, that for the sake of children, for the sake of the safety of our community, including the wider human community in other countries, surely it's better that he is somewhere where both civil and, if appropriate, church restrictions can continue.
Bishop Peter Comensoli speaking with RN's Noel Debien, and you'll hear a full discussion on the spirit of things on Sunday week. That's two Sundays away on RN, and you're with Andrew West. Australia's Grand Mufti, Sheikh Abdul Azim Al Afifi, has died only 4 months after becoming the country's most senior Muslim cleric. Sheikh Al Afifi was a popular, softly spoken man who led congregations in Australia for 20 years. Multicultural Affairs Minister Alan Tudge described the Grand Mufti as, quote, a man of peace and goodwill. Finally, world leaders are praising the Thai Navy divers, the foreign rescue crews, and the Australian doctor who saved 12 teenage soccer players and their coach from a flooded cave in Thailand. The boys and their coach were hungry and in darkness for almost 2 weeks. So apart from water and a few rations, what kept them going? Richard Lloyd Parry of the Times of London covered the rescue and told us about the importance of the Buddhist faith to the survivors and to Thailand.
From the very beginning, this is obviously a crisis that has presented amazing technical challenges. Just the job of penetrating these water-filled caves, finding the boys and then getting them out. But from very early on, from the beginning really, Thais also enlisted or attempted to enlist spiritual and supernatural forces to help them in this. And this was very natural because the cave site itself is and was long before this happened a place rich in myth and legend and spiritual associations.
Yes, tell us about the spiritual associations and the myth around it. The Great Cave of the Sleeping Lady. Who's the Sleeping Lady?
Well, the Sleeping Lady is a princess of ancient times called Jiao Mei Nang Non, who fell in love, as princesses in myth do from time to time, with a commoner, with a stable boy. And she fell pregnant and she eloped with him. And they were pursued by the soldiers of her father, the king, who eventually caught up with them in this cave, where the boy was killed by the soldiers. And the pregnant princess, grief-stricken, killed herself, cut her own throat. Mm-hmm. And in the legend, her prone body became this mountain. And as you said, it's a very distinctive mountain that rises out of a relatively flat area. And if you use your imagination a bit, you can see it as the body of a woman lying on the ground. And her blood became the river that runs through this cave. And that's where these boys unwittingly got trapped over 2 weeks ago.
Do we know why the boys went into the cave? Was it a religious motivation? Because their coach is quite a devout man.
I don't think it was. I mean, the truth is we don't know. No one's really had a chance to talk to them very much. From what we know, they'd had their football practice. One of them had a birthday. They went to the cave to have a bit of fun, to have a picnic. Went in quite a long way and the water rose. But it is true that their coach, who is a man named Ekapol Chantawong, is a 25-year-old man, and he spent a number of years as a Buddhist monk. Now, that may sound more unusual than it actually is in Thailand. In Thailand, it's very common for young men from their teens upwards to spend anything from a few weeks to years as Buddhist monks, shaving their heads, taking on the saffron robes. And it's not the same as, becoming a monk in Australia or Europe is. Mm. It's more like a kind of part of a young man's education.
Yes, almost a rite of passage, Richard.
Yeah, it's almost like doing national service, except you're not becoming a soldier, you're becoming a monk. So anyway, he did that and spent probably a longer period than average as a monk. And, of course, studied Buddhism and studied meditation. Now, there's a lot of sort of rumour and talk swirling. And the fact is, we really don't know yet. But a lot of people are assuming that one of the reasons the boys appeared when they were first found so calm and collected, really strikingly so in that first video, is that their coach, Ek, had been meditating with them. And that, a technique like that obviously could be very useful in dealing with an extremely stressful situation of being trapped in the darkness in a cave.
Yes, well, could we even assume that the meditation that their coach led them on may have been one of the reasons that they managed to survive, to get through this while they were in the darkness there?
Well, people who meditate say there are, of course, and I think, it's quite well established that kind of practice, focusing, clearing the mind, your pulse slows down, your metabolism slows down. That's very good for people. I don't think there's any doubt of that. To be honest, we just don't know. It's a supposition that he did that. but it would make sense if he had.
I think the young boys themselves will spend some time as Buddhist monks in local monasteries. What do we know about what's going to happen with them?
Well, it's very interesting. I discovered this when I was talking to one of their teachers, and it was confirmed to us by one of the parents of the boys that the parents, of course, there was this 9-day period when no one knew if they were alive or dead. And the parents were beside themselves, and they were praying at the cave to the goddess there, and also going to the monasteries and praying to Buddha. And they struck a bargain with these deities and said that if you bring our sons back, we will commit them to the monkhood. So perhaps rather to their surprise, and I suspect they don't know it yet, these young boys, who we know love football, but we don't know whether they love Buddhism, will, after they've recovered in due time, and when I think they've had a bit of time with their family, be sent to a monastery for, not for a very long time, for a few weeks or maybe for a month, as a kind of fulfillment of a bargain that was cut with the spiritual forces. I think there's that, but it's also, people say, well, you know, if you've been through something like that, then going into a monastery and kind of isolating yourself from the world to a certain extent and living a very simple life might be not a bad way of dealing with the after effects of such an ordeal.
Times reporter Richard Lloyd Parry from the rescue site in northern Thailand. Just before we go, later this month, Melbourne will host a major conference on the exploitation of women. We'll put a link on our website. One of the thorny issues will be surrogacy. Ahead of the conference, we'll bring you an interview with the controversial Swedish writer Kajsa Ekis Ekman. Here's a preview.
I'm a feminist, and I consider surrogacy to be an exploitation of women and also a trade in babies, because surrogacy has many similarities to prostitution. I mean, we see here that it's just another part of a woman's body that is being sold. And we also see the same arguments reoccurring, such as, oh, it's her own choice, and so on. And we also see now trafficking happening in the surrogacy industry. But in the surrogacy industry, we have another thing complicating the whole ethical debate, and that is the child, because the child does not get to choose the fact that he or she will never meet his mother again.
Yes, I mean, how does surrogacy violate the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned this. Now, I'm a member of the Swedish network Feminist No to Surrogacy, and we repeatedly say this, but in the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, it explicitly states that a child has a right to his or her parents and to grow up with them as long as it's possible. And of course, that phrase means that we all know sometimes it happens that children become orphans, that parents, because of addiction or because of other problems, aren't fit to take care of their children. And in that case, adoption might be the best. But what happens in surrogacy is that the intended parents just want the mother to be a kind of machine to be pregnant, deliver the baby, and then disappear. So they don't want her to take part in the life of this child. This is most often the case. So they're denying both the mother the right to her child and the child the right to his or her mother.
That interview with Kajsa Ekis Ekman in a couple of weeks on the Religion and Ethics Report. And you can find us at the RN website and the ABC Listen app. Thanks to Muditha Dias and Wayne Ewan. I'm Andrew West. I'm back next week.